Today's episode of The Bladder Presents is brought to you, in part, by Best Evidence subscribers. Thanks, guys. The Best Evidence newsletter is even more of the true crime that's worth your time, or not. And even I would love for you to join the conversation at bestevidence.fyi. And now, today's episode.
I had an interview set up with Larry Poole, the Orange County investigator who has led the cold case task force since the mid-90s.
Every investigator I know that's been given the opportunity to examine this case feels that it's the case that they want solved before they die.
Recorded on the day the Golden State Killer pled guilty to his myriad crimes, Mike and I take a look at I'll Be Gone in the Dark, the HBO docuseries about the GSK, and about Michelle McNamara's journey into the heart of that case's darkness. Later, we'll go from Golden State to Garden State to talk about a Murder Made Me Famous episode on Lacey Township's so-called prom mom. And after that, Mike is probably never talking to me again about anything. Regrettable halo effects, repellent sound effects, and the death of a two-decade friendship. It's The Plotter Presents, episode 149. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast that tries to find the true crime worth your time. My guest probably felt like he was doing time prepping for this episode. Please welcome, possibly for the very last time, Michael Dunn. Hello, Mike.
Hello, and never, because this is the third meeting of the Carol Daly Appreciation Society, and I want to have many more of these.
Well, I had remarks prepared about how we had a good run, but I'm glad you're prepared to stick with this this project known as our friendship. All right, well, the most wanted section today is not going to place anyone in any jeopardy, so let's get into it. We are talking, of course, of I'll Be Gone in the Dark, HBO's six-part docuseries from Liz Garbus and others about I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which we have talked about, you and I, several times on this podcast in various ways, including auxiliary Holzianna over the years. Mm-hmm. In case anyone did not realize that this was a thing, here's the case file adapted from HBO's landing page. Quote, a six-part documentary series based on the book of the same name, I'll Be Gone in the Dark explores writer Michelle McNamara's investigation into the dark world of the violent predator she dubbed the Golden State Killer. Directed by Academy Award nominee and Emmy-winning director Liz Garbus, responsible for, among others, HBO's Who Killed Garrett Phillips, Nothing Left Unsaid, Gloria Vanderbilt and Anderson Cooper, and the HBO press team didn't mention this, but frequent topic of conversation in Blotter and Best Evidence precincts, There's Something Wrong with Aunt Diane. The series is a detective story told in McNamara's own words through exclusive original recordings and excerpts from her book read by actor Amy Ryan. Drawing on extensive archival footage and police files, as well as exclusive new interviews with detectives, survivors, and family members of the killer, the series weaves together a picture of a complex and flawed investigation that challenged police for decades. The series is also a journey into the soul of McNamara, whose True Crime Diaries blog and years of relentless determination for justice for the victims helped keep the case alive and in the public eye, and who tragically died of an accidental overdose while writing her book, end quote. Here is where I will issue a content warning. The Golden State Killer was also the East Area Rapist and the original Night Stalker. Accounts of his crimes are not really something we're delving into that much, but please listen with care for yourselves. As always, content warning for sexual assault and misogynoir. Okay. So I have already reviewed this. For primetimer.com, there's a link to that piece in the show notes. I will try not to repeat myself in case there's any overlap in listeners and readers, but Mike, let's actually start with you. How many of the three episodes that I furnished did you watch, and what were your overall impressions from those?
I did watch all three, but I probably spent more time with the first two, going back and doing some, taking some notes and doing some research. And I spent a lot of time with the second episode. I thought this, I'll just say up front, I'm enjoying this so far. I am liking this series. I am looking forward to seeing what happens in the last three episodes. Although,
same here.
At the same time, I think at the same time that we may not need three additional episodes. I mean, I've got a thing about, you know, existing cases, or not existing cases, but stories that we know about already, then producing another extreme, what seems like an extremely long documentary that may not be needed. But I'm going to go back to what I do like about the fact about this, the show so far, is that it doesn't feel like any of the other documentaries I've seen about the Golden State Killer thus far. They are incorporating a lot of Michelle into the series and into this show. But at the same time, I think it's having a little trouble trying to balance between the journey into Michelle's storyline and her drive. And as you said in the introduction, the diving into her soul, and trying to balance it with the details of the case. And I think most people that are watching this already know the story about the case anyway. So I think it's trying to ride this balancing act, and I'm not necessarily sure if it's executing it 100%, but I do want to say that I am enjoying it, and I particularly thought episode 2 was a fantastic episode. I definitely liked it more than 1 and 3. There was elements of that actually scared me. I liked the deep dive back into a lot of old 1970s like news clips, mm-hmm. and 70s people and ideas and norms, how men thought about rape, or what we should say didn't think about rape,
yeah,
during the 70s, and what it actually meant. I thought I did a really, really good job of highlighting that ignorance, and I was really happy to see that included in part of it. So like I said, I'm enjoying it. The balancing act, I think it's having trouble with. I don't know how it's going to end up in episodes 4, 5, and 6. But I'm along for the ride, and I'm enjoying it. And there's a lot of things that I do like about it, and we can, you know, go over individual things that I like about it. But, you know, what's your thoughts? And I did read your article, but want to hear you dive into it a little bit more too.
Well, that's pretty much where I came out. I don't think I actually did a great job articulating this in the article, but someone on Twitter today said that he wasn't entirely sure that he agreed with my take. And okay, having only seen one episode, he's like, well, maybe it's different after you've seen a few, but I'm into it. I think right, it's well done. And
okay, so that's a person who's only seen the first
right,
episode so far, basically. Yeah.
But what I said to him was like, I think, you know, I didn't find a way to put this effectively in the piece, I don't think, but I think you're right on that. It's trying to be both things and to show how a traditional true crime story and like digging into it, discovering its outlines, unpacking it, trying to solve this mystery can affect this more crime noir based journey into the heart mm-hmm. of this darkness on McNamara's part, which, right, okay, it's not impossible to do that. But I think you're right that it's having trouble. Like there's some abrupt tacks back and forth between the two sides of the story, and mm-hmm. In my opinion, some of the most effective true crime storytelling of the last 3 years has been stories where the finding of the story is also the story, like Catch and Kill by Ronan Farrow is one example. So this is not impossible to do, and Liz Garbus is, you know, clearly not incapable of like marshalling this kind of difficult narrative. But I think that it actually, if she had only just gone, not even chronologically, but just sort of gotten behind McNamara and looked over her shoulder and driven it from that standpoint, mm-hmm. that the details of the crime would come through that way.
They would come out still.
Yeah.
Right.
And that you're not, yeah, not to mention that this is an enormously vast case from a long time ago. There's a lot of different, there's like different jurisdictions. It goes on for a while.
Yep.
This monster was prolific. And
yes,
like it's a lot. But on the other hand, he's just a sicko who, it turns out, was fairly, had his habits. So I think it was doable that way. And I think the other place that it runs into trouble, in my opinion, is that if it's going to be this crime noir and you're going to do an investigation of the author and her process and this darkness, which mm-hmm. like here again, this is a archetype probably of true crime writers. McGinnis getting random nosebleeds. Truman Capote's life was basically destroyed right. after In Cold Blood. There were a lot of factors there, and I won't get into it, but mm-hmm. Fine. But I think that then this docuseries needs to be a little more critical of McNamara's work, not in a mean way, but just... Mm-hmm. I think that the access to... this exclusive stuff, which in the main, I suspect, was provided by her widower, Mr. Patton Oswalt, meant that Garbus et al. Felt reluctant and careful about including any commentary on McNamara that was not extremely positive and reverent. And I think that was a problem in the book. She wasn't gotten out yep. of her own way on the pro side, and it's a problem here. Would you agree?
I do agree, because I knew that Patton was going to be a part of this somehow. And like for like the first episode and a half, I just kept watching him on the screen going, does he really need to be here other than the fact that he's a famous guy that was married to Michelle McNamara? Because I initially didn't think that he was offering anything to... interesting or new to the show. And that's no offense to Patton. I'm a fan of his comedy and such. But I just didn't think that, other than his celebrity, he didn't really need to be included in the in what I had seen. And then to bring up the point that you were referencing, boy, did they spend a lot of time making sure that they got all of Patton's positive reinforcement text messages to her included.
Yeah.
When she was struggling at the end there.
Well,
and that's a wonderful,
fine.
Nice thing to do
yeah.
and everything. But it didn't really tell us about, as she was approaching the completion of the book, which we sadly know she did not get to do, that I think I would have preferred to hear more about the struggle other than just positive reinforcement that she was getting from her husband. It would have been a little bit more interesting.
And that, here's her, the editor-in-chief of her imprint at HarperCollins being like, I haven't seen prose like this since Capote. Like, you know what?
Exactly.
McNamara yeah. herself would be like, you need to step back. Like, look, there are a lot of different skill sets to being a true crime investigative reporter. A lot of different skill sets. McNamara had most of them. Sometimes her prose was right. really strained. I don't see what the harm is at this point in saying right. that and following the law of Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, which is... unless your shit is really good, keep it off screen and just tell us it's good. Don't show right. us, because Aaron Sorkin has a lot of skill sets also, but being hilarious is not one of them.
Definitely not one of them, no.
Yeah, and it's just like, I think we said this about the book too. It's just a pity. Like, I really think McNamara is our people and we would have enjoyed her personally.
Absolutely, yes.
I find her extremely relatable, but it's like... I don't know, like, if this is going to be a memoir of her life and her writing journey, mm-hmm. like...
Well, I'll tell you when I started becoming, like ear-related to her, and it was, I feel bad about saying this, but I was getting lost listening to Michelle initially. They have these interviews with her, but then Amy Ryan's voiceover lost me completely, because I lost Michelle. I did not see Michelle in Amy Ryan's voiceovers that she was doing of the readings from the book. I was not hearing Michelle's voice. I was just hearing an actress, to be honest with you, reading. I wasn't getting the same voice that I was hearing Michelle express in the other interviews that she was giving. And I actually found Amy Ryan's voiceovers to be a bit of a distraction.
I did not care for them either. I'm glad you said that. And I mentioned in the Primetimer piece that Ryan is like really spreading some acting mustard on it, which, like, that's her job. Fine. I like Amy Ryan, but when these are juxtaposed with when Michelle is just like naturally talking to like whatever that home video, whoever she was talking to for that, if that was like a vlog, I'm unclear. But mm-hmm. she had a very natural way of talking about the case that was much better writing than when she was really like on True Crime Diary being like, you know, impatience mm-hmm. roils, like, please understand what transitive and intransitive verbs do and do not do. Anyway, I'm going to play a clip, finally, says the entire listenership, which is down to four people. I'm going to play a clip because I think this is an interesting juxtaposition here between Patton Oswalt, who is at the beginning of the clip, talking about Michelle's motivations and Michelle's more, like, less lofty, more adrenaline junkie take on the same thing, which is, I think, at the crux of the problem for me that we've just been talking about. So here's clip two.
Right.
I remember Michelle ultimately wanted to serve helping to get this guy caught. She looked at it from the hopeful, optimistic humans putting puzzles together, trying to get closure, trying to make sense of violence and despair.
I mean, what drives me is the need to put a face on a unknown killer. And what I love is this intersection of sort of technology and crime solving, in that people can get sort of wheeled out of their house for something they did in 1957 because of the internet, because of DNA. I really get off on that. That is so amazing to me. And I want to be a part of that. Nothing, it's, you know, everyone has their cause. And this just feels like what I was born to do.
I mean, that's like not entirely like altruistic and honorable as a motivation. Like, she's curious and she wants to crack the code. That's fine. She was also really good at centering these victims and this like blast radius of damage that this fucking asshole left, which that's fine too. Those things can coexist, but the problem that I was consistently having in the first and also the third episode to an extent was this halo effect that you just have to wonder, like, in the timeline where she is still with us, or if this is made sort of like from further away and with less access but also less influence from Patton Oswalt, like, what does this, like, does this look a little different and a little more balanced? Because look, she was formidable at a lot of things, but just like, you're really going to step to Capote with this writing? Like, and I think 95 out of 100 people are going to be like, yeah, that sure, she's as good as Capote. Mm-hmm. And that's like, I don't need to go door to door and be like, she's actually just a B minus. Like, I really don't. Right. But that's like, she actually was so accomplished that it's like, why are we gilding this lily? You're just going to kill it.
And I think that Capote reference was even just to the article, not even to the book that she had written yet, right? It was just to the article from LA Magazine.
Yeah. And it's like, I don't want to be rude, but like, article. Texas Monthly, ever heard of it? Pamela Koloff does this every week. Sorry, what were you saying?
No, it was basically what you were just saying. It's like, I've read the article and I went back and reread the article ahead of doing this, and it's fine. It's a very good article. It would intrigue me, you know, if I didn't know about the case at that point in time when it was written, but to compare it to In Cold Blood, I mean, let's pump the brakes a little bit here, if you don't mind.
Yeah, just a little.
And then when you're making reference to the I need to know who it is, I need to see his face. I mean, and that drips and bleeds of Graysmith and the Zodiac too, which is she was saying how that, God, I want to get the Zodiac page. You know, your 15 minutes of fame have come and gone already. I want it to be about this.
Right.
And then her desire to find out who it is. And I was like, I've watched that Zodiac movie and I've read that book a number of times, and Graysmith over and over. It's like, I need to know who it is. I need to see his face.
Yeah.
And Graysmith doesn't come across as a very, you know, likable, lovely character either.
No. Also, you know, he's not a good writer either. So. Like, most of this genre is fucking garbaggio. Like, even the good ones, like McGinnis is like, whatever you think of his like, you know, journalistic ethics. On the prose level, right, he's kind of just okay. And you sort of get sucked into the stories that he picks and the research that he does. Like, writing is hard. Like, look, not to be quoting Jimmy Dugan here, but like, if it wasn't hard, everyone would do it. The hardest what makes it great. Like, at whatever. It's just too bad that much time is spent. Also, I think people who are watching this, like, already believe in her.
But even if that was her attitude, you didn't have to tell us about it, because we already know her desire and her drive to find out, to want to know who this is and to help settle the
case.
And
like, not every aspect of people doing their jobs and trying to do it well, especially in this sector of media, is going to be, covered in altruistic glory. Like, the true crime industry is an industry. I think we all have to confront that every day that we're doing this and remember who pays. But that, like, I don't have a problem with her being like, I want to see this guy's face. Like, fucking, of course you do. You've given so many hours of your life to this. Yeah. So,
I mean, even watching I watched a little bit of the hearings today and the guilty pleas. And I remember when they arrested this guy. And I remember the district attorney or the county prosecutor giving the press conference. And I kept thinking about all the people that we know from this case that did a lot of the heavy lifting, your Paul Holzes, your Carol Dalys, mm-hmm. your Larry Crompton, barely got any mention about their involvement and their dirty fingernails whatsoever. And I found it kind of disgraceful. Still, and I was reminded of that today when I was watching the hearings, that these were people that were doing it because they wanted to solve the case. They weren't looking for glory, and it's a good thing, because they weren't getting any.
Yeah,
they weren't. They were kind of being pushed to the side during all of this, which is kind of crazy. Their fame is through these documentaries and not through the actual reportings on the case itself via the media, via the county prosecutors and such. So I think they're perfectly fine with that.
Yeah, I think so too. And certainly, like, people like Paul Holes and Billy Jensen, like, you know, they're doing fine. Right. And, I mean, not to belabor the point, but it's like, I do think it's interesting, if you're following a hearing like this on Twitter, there's like a certain sector of people that are complaining that Michelle McNamara is not being mentioned by name, even though they use the name that she coined for him. And it's like, well, I don't know. Okay. Like, it kind of doesn't matter now. Let me play another clip, which I think, you know, not to hammer on this, but I think sort of highlights the problem that I'm talking about here, which in this clip, I think in the beginning you're hearing from Karen Kilgariff of My Favorite Murder, who's just talking about McNamara's role in centering the victim and like gross exploitationifying some aspects of the coverage, which is like, I do think she was focused on that. I don't think she's the Philo Farnsworth of that idea here. And I would really like it if we could just give her the gold medal that she earned and not give everyone else's gold medals to her also, because she would be grossed out by that, not least for that. So, I mean, what do I know? I didn't know her personally, but here's clip three.
Most of the TV shows that would cover these stories were very cold or really kind of exploitive. You spent a bunch of time watching a reenactment of a beautiful young actress being attacked over and over while wearing lingerie. But Michelle's blog kind of changed, I think, the focus. She personalized those people.
If you can remind people about the humanity at the other end of that gun. This was a person with hopes and dreams, with family, that could have done this, this, or this. That's what Michelle did in her writing.
All right, here we go, folks. We've got Michelle McNamara. She's a writer and a web sleuth. She has taught college writing, worked as an editor, sold TV pilots, and also consulted for Dateline. She is a truth seeker, is what she is. Let's face it, you have a career, you have a life, because people are always going to get murdered.
Wow.
You deal in the devil.
The murder biz.
The murder biz.
Gross. This is exactly what I was talking about before, that even as just a reviewer, and particularly lately, as we've all been talking and thinking, hopefully more, about Black Lives Matter, about defunding the police, et cetera, and so on, that you always have to grapple with how much of your life and commentary has to do with other people's anguish. And particularly, like, how much of, you know, my little corner of the true crime reviewing world, it is like standing on women's bodies and Black bodies. So yeah. I think that she really did, I think she really did illuminate what a terrifying experience this was for the victim, the ones who survived, for the victims. And I think that that was important to her. And we hear, I think in episode 3, that someone says that she's a really good interviewer. And I think that's, it's a difficult skill. It's not one I possess, in my opinion. And I think she is great at that. But all of these things coexist, and they're so complicated when you, like, work in the true crime sector. And I am both frustrated at how this is being kind of sanded down so far, and fascinated to see more of its effect on her and, like, her writings and her communication with Patton Oswalt and other people as the series goes on, because I think that she really just had a lot to tell all of us about that, and now she can't, and it sucks.
Right.
So when I express frustration at, like, that this show is fluffing her, that's why. It's not that I think she doesn't deserve it. She wasn't taking my money. It's not about that. I just, I review true crime, and I want this property to be better at balancing that.
And I think that's my disconnect when I mentioned the voiceover by Amy Ryan, because I actually would have to go back and read the book to see, okay, what we're looking for, was it in the book, and is it not being expressed yet in the series? And even if they do get to it, they do start expressing it that way. Am I going to be able to buy it listening to Amy Ryan's voice doing it? I keep saying her voice, but I just mean it's not Michelle's voice to me anymore.
I think there's,
and that's my problem.
No, I agree with you. And there is a moment, I think in episode 3, where they're talking about how what she's really struggling with writing the book when she gets the book deal is putting her own voice in it, and, like, going back and, like, going back and forth between Sacramento in the 70s and, where's she from again? Oak Park? Oak Cliff?
Oak Park, outside of Chicago. Yeah.
So the Chicago suburbs, and, like, her fraught relationship with her mom. And then, like, I don't know if this is the way in, and I don't know if it is, why we keep coming back out of it and going back to this B-roll of her, like, crazy wall about East Area Rapist. Like, I don't know. It's frustrating. Like, there's so much to this story, and I just want it to be as good as possible and, like, do her work for her when she can't. So,
yes.
But let's talk about episode 2, because there is a lot in episode 2 that I think does an outstanding job.
Yes.
Be it, like, underlining how fucking creepy this guy was. Like, in addition to being a felonious monster, he was also misdemeanor weird. And that there was no understanding that we have now about how to deal with survivors of sexual assault on the part of the police and law enforcement. So you were going to call for this clip from a hypnosis session with one of the victims, but I had already put it in the doc, so let's hear that.
I looked out on the back patio.
Well, what did you see outside?
A man
How would you describe his face?
My hairs on my arm are raised. I'm going to take a picture and text it to you. I swear to God.
I believe you. Mine too.
It's.
Did you ever see The Changeling? Not the Angelina Jolie one, the old one with George C. Scott, the horror movie?
Oh, many, many years ago. Many years ago. It's been a long time.
The place in this woman that the word mean comes from reminds me of the medium, like talking to Joseph in the house, and like the way the voice like changes as it's coming through. I mean, it's dark. So that was that was well done. And I'm actually going to skip ahead to the last clip of the section, which is from episode 3. But the way the director of this episode sort of lets the prank call go on. At first, you're just like, you know, in addition to being a rapist, you're also a cretin. Like, that's just like the banality of evil indeed. But then it gets really scary at the end. So here's clip 7.
And you and I have heard this clip before, but not all of it.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, like, you know, before that, you actually do hear the victim picking up the phone and saying hello, too. I never even heard that part before. So hearing it all the way through and those extra add-ons at the end that you and I hadn't heard before, again, hair raising on my arms, chilling. I'm sleeping with the lights on tonight. And I mean, my
especially since by that by the beginning of episode 3, and that's where that footage is from, it has been established that whoever this guy is, and we're not at the point in the docuseries where we know, he has been casing the houses. He I mean, now we know he was a cop, but to talk about defund the police, fuck. But he, like, he had been watching and preparing and organizing and setting these things up, and that he would then sort of return to the scene to create more fear, which is what he got off on. That I'll Be Gone in the Dark has done a very good job setting that scene, and then does a very good job reminding you that this was not, like, this was happening when there was no internet, there were barely telex machines, definite linkage blindness. A lot of law enforcement officers didn't really, like, think about serial killers or understand what they were. Like, it kind of took Ted Bundy for other jurisdictions to be like, oh, that's what that is. So like, they're completely overmatched by this guy who's basically one of their own. Shall we play the delightful victim blaming of yesteryear clip?
Yeah, but before you do that, the one thing is just based on the last two clips. I mean, those were the two opening clips for episodes 2 and 3.
Yeah.
And then the opening clip for episode 1 was that scene with of Patton signing, autographing the book on the prologue pages that he wrote.
Yeah.
And I was, and I thought that was chilling because the books were always handed to him with the flap being Michelle's face on the inside flap of the back
cover. Mark the page.
So he's to mark the page. So he's opening it up and there he's seeing his deceased wife and then having to open it up, sign it and pass it along. And I thought that was chilling too. The three openings and intros to the show. And might we add our girl, Amy Mann's cover of a Leonard Cohen song.
Yes,
is amazing as well.
I completely forgot to bring that up. I should have clipped that.
Cause that song is chilling too.
That's a really good point. I'm glad that you brought that up because I think that that's an extremely effective distillation, just like as an opening shot across the bow of the story that yes. Garbus and the other directors are like, you know, this is all tied together with like family, narrative as commodity, pain as commodity, that yes. the story sort of like weaves back on itself. I mean, that's that's really well done. Like, look, this isn't, we're about to talk about some garbage bullshit in a few minutes, and this is not that. But yeah. as always with this story and with McNamara, it's the same way I feel about Kesha. Like, I'm always rooting so hard for you, girl. But when, but if you shank one in down the third baseline, like, that's not a home run. It's foul ball. Right. Can't we call things what they are? Anyway, let me wind up with this clip, which incorporates the woman talking at the beginning is, I think this is Barbeau, the one of the yes. citizen detectives. And then we have some newscasters of the late 70s and their talking head interviewees being depressingly real about rape.
Yeah, and we saw where Ron Burgundy may have gotten their influence and inspiration from. My goodness.
Yeah. Here's clip five.
Rape in the 70s was a crime like a simple assault. It was not considered a big deal. The sentence for raping somebody could be 30 days, could be 90 days. You get probation. There was no real crime statute for sexual assault. And so I think when these crimes began, you know, you looked at the way women were treated.
Sex offender today has a greater number of available women to choose from. There are more working women, single women living alone, not with their families or with men.
Because of the mobility and the visibility of today's woman, she must learn to understand the rapist. For today's woman to understand the rapist, she's got to learn to understand the man.
Fuck you. Like, that guy's probably dead now, so what's the point? But, like, y'all, also, this is just victim blaming for stranger rape, which is the only kind that law enforcement even acknowledged. And it was still perfectly legal for a man to rape his wife at this time, I'm pretty sure. So gross, American society, do better. I know everyone's working on it, but so
frightening.
Yeah.
Frightening, which was why I still love that scene of our girl, Carol Daly, basically saying, this guy comes into the house, you'll go ahead, kill him.
Yeah.
You have a gun, shoot him. Yeah, that's what I'd say. I'd be like,
she's like, yeah, he's not going to learn that response. You're not going to talk him out of it. Yeah.
Right. But I also felt that you got that feeling that like Carol heard all of this shit in her offices as well. Remember, there was one comment where they said the cops made reference to, oh, well, at least he raped one of the pretty ones. And I just lost my shit. And that's why I was like, I kept thinking back to Carol Daly saying, go ahead, shoot them. I think it kind of came out of not even just a, this is a predator, but just, you know what? I'm just angry as hell. Shoot them.
Yeah.
You know, I think
it would be a better like reflection of the material and a better homage to McNamara's journey and process to have it be something that you like stay up all night watching the whole thing. And then you go on the internet and talk about it.
Yeah.
So I don't
feel that need either.
Yeah. I don't think they're doing that, but yeah, I'll Be Gone in the Dark. Like, I once again am frustrated that the culture's relationship with Michelle McNamara has to be so like kind of binary and flat. Because this was a full human. But with all of that said, I hope she would be happy with this. It is well built. Like, Liz Garbus doesn't win things for no reason. And I'm excited to see what else they come up with and what else we get to see that we've never seen before, because you and I have seen pretty much the whole, like all the available stuff for this case,
right?
Materials for this case. So yeah, it airs on Sundays on HBO, and let us know what you thought of it at Blotter Presents on Twitter. All right, we've put it off long enough.
Oh, God.
It's time for the cold case.
It's the end of our friendship.
I guess it's fitting that... didn't our friendship start because you, like, happened to hear Amy Mann coming out of my car?
And seeing a TomatoNation.com yes. bumper sticker on the back of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and here, Amy Mann is here to see this, to put this friendship on an ice floe and push it out to sea. Okay. So what we're actually talking about is a show on Reels with a Z. In case you're not familiar, this is the like way up the basic cable dial channel that does shit like The Autopsy of, insert famous person, or The Last mm-hmm. Hours of, it's, like, it's pretty, it's very tabloidy and exploitive and gross, but I was looking for a Jersey case for us to talk about. There was a perfectly good American Greed episode about a mob boiler room scam, and it, I could not find it online anywhere, so I was like, fine, we'll just watch this. I had no idea. I had no idea how fucking bad. All right. So Murder Made Me Famous, season 4, episode 6, Prom Mom. I am going to put the content warning here for the death of an infant. Later on, the content warning will be for gruesome sound effects, sexual content somehow. This show is completely out of control, and I am... offended.
But you haven't mentioned the scariest thing yet. It inspired a song by Nickelback.
Oh, yeah. And a Family Guy episode with a parody musical number. Yeah, I wrote that
That's
down.
Right.
And then I threw up until I turned inside out. Okay, here's the actual case file adapted from Wikipedia. Although, now that I've said Prom Mom, you probably recall some variation on this case from one of the numerous times a Law & Order franchise adapted it. But anyway, from Wikipedia, here we go. Quote, on June 6, 1997, Melissa Drexler gave birth in a bathroom stall at her senior prom 20 minutes after complaining of stomach cramps in the car she had arrived in. Sidebar, whoever wrote this, who cares which car? Anyway, resume quote. She retrieved the baby from the toilet bowl, placed it in a plastic bag, and deposited it in a trash can. It is thought that she severed the umbilical cord on the serrated edge of a sanitary napkin dispenser. According to the prosecutor, a friend asked if she was all right, and she replied, "I'll be done pretty soon. Go tell the boys we'll be right out." She then returned to the dance floor, ate a salad, and danced with her boyfriend. End quote. Drexler got 15 years for this neonaticide, but was released in 2001 and apparently is now married and a mother of two. She has never spoken about that night, which might explain why Murder Made Me Famous felt obliged to stretch both the horrendous birth scene and Melissa's first time having intercourse with the baby's father out so interminably. Why is a story so terrible rendered in a fashion so laughable? Let's discuss.
Did you say disgust or disgust?
Yes.
I didn't quite catch that. So.
Control A. Mike, yes. you had some feelings about the narration by Mr. Brad Osborne. Would you like to express those thoughts?
Well, okay. First of all, not even just him. It seemed like everybody that they chose to have as a talking head or to do some form of narration or voiceover in this just had a really strange and creepy voice. Everyone. The detective, was his name? Wade, I believe. Or, Neil Kay.
Yes.
Neil Kay. I'm sorry. The medical doctor. And listening to him talk about things about the pregnancy, and then listening to the way that the narrator would say, I'm trying to find a good instance to try to capture how he said. Oh, there was one instance where he talked about how they were the first time they had sex, and it was like the two sneak away for sex before he starts his night shifts. I'm just like, does it really need to sound like that?
We have a clip for that.
Oh, you.
Of all, everything about this episode is very amateurish. I mean, like, right down to the chyrons, which identify this forensic psychologist that they're talking to as being from, like, Heckeson, Delaware. Like, who cares? Like, oh, well, that's sort of close to Lacey Township. A, no, it isn't. And B, who cares? Some interviewees' makeup was terrible. Others misspoke, like, just used the wrong word, and it wasn't suggested that they have another take. The sound design is extremely weird. Like, often they're, like, in the rain, and the sound of the rain is deafening. Like, please don't use a parabolic mic for this. Like, I notice sound stuff more now, but...
Did you get the feeling a lot of this was actually written for all of these talking heads to read, that it wasn't actually their...
Yeah, I do.
Like a lot of it was they probably, like, gave interviews and whatnot and discussed the case, and then they were like, all right, well, we're going to write up copy for you, and we want you to read that, because we want it to sound as cheesy as possible.
Yeah.
And because some of the things that some of these people were saying, I mean, like, they had prosecutors and doctors from Monmouth County, and I couldn't believe that these were actually things that they were saying. It felt like it had to have been written, maybe by the People magazine senior crime reporter.
Oh, brother. Well,
Steve Helleck. Oh my goodness.
We'll get to that mofo. First, okay, we're going to hear the clip that you were talking about. If the story is only half an hour, just make a half hour episode. Don't pad it out with this extremely awkward rendition of this girl's first time doing it. If we had to suffer, so do y'all. Clip 8.
Soon, Melissa and John begin dating. And although she is allegedly inexperienced, the two sneak away for sex before John starts his night shifts at a local store.
Is that all right?
I didn't know it was going to hurt.
Oh. It should only hurt for a minute.
Yeah. Kill Jesus.
Does that matter?
Yeah.
Good.
Little do they know that their secret sexual liaisons will end in a very sinister and public way.
I mean, okay. First of all, while this is happening, you can't see this, but there's a total, like, Titanic hand on the car window thing.
Yep. Steamy window, steamy
happening.
Backseat.
Like, yes. Cut. Like, most of the people watching this remember the backseat of the car. Like, we got it. Oh, yeah. God, we got it. No, it's so cringy. And then the writing also doesn't really seem to understand, or it can't decide, like, was everyone really aware that that Melissa was gaining weight and eating a lot and, like, looked pregnant? Or was it a complete surprise to everyone? Like, to stop including reenacted scenes of literally every other girl at the school being like, so are you pregnant or what?
And can we talk about the hungry scene? Was that not stolen straight out of Mean Girls?
Yeah.
Hungry much? No, I just skipped breakfast. And in Mean Girls, watch where you're going, fat ass. It felt like they were just trying to steal things from movies to tie into this story over and over and over again.
I mean,
that was the first thing I thought of was Rachel McAdams now having a big ass in that movie. And
I will give the reenactors credit. They are trying heroically to make this work, but it doesn't. Here's clip 9.
According to reports, no one actually suspects that Melissa is carrying a baby.
Jeez, Melissa, you're getting fat or you're getting pregnant?
Probably pregnant.
Rude!
Why would you put this scene right after a voiceover that's like, well, nobody could tell seconds later. The narrator's seconds later, the scene's like, everybody could tell. Like,
yeah. Except the boyfriend and the parents.
Yeah, and everyone else. Except that everyone else could also tell. And then she's just like wanly shoving French fries into her mouth. Like, the thing is, this sort of dissociation, and they try to have the talking head interviewees explain psychologically how a girl in this situation dissociates from what she thinks of as like an unwanted condition, and that once this thing comes out of her and then cries, revealing itself not to be a thing, but like a problem with a voice, then she may feel as though she has no choice but to act in a lethal way. I mean, this, on top of that, like, that there's still so much shame around teen pregnancy, that girls, this was an 18-year-old, but apparently she didn't feel like she had access to anything, like information about birth control, reproductive health, that her boyfriend, I didn't clip this, but like, has he ever even watched TV before? That she's like, I'm late. And he's like, what? And she's like, my period, it's late. And he's like, I don't get it. Like, oh my God.
The ending of that was the best though, because that's when he yelled at her and was like, why don't you have birth control? And then she basically says, oh, it's okay, I'll be fine. And he's like, cool, let's go play Space Invaders.
Yeah.
And
like,
first of all, this was in the 90s. The Space Invaders was like 1981. Who's playing Space Invaders in 1997 in an arcade?
Yeah.
Nobody.
And if you're going to invade her vaginal space, maybe you could wear a Jimmy hat, Professor.
There you go.
Fuck you.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Space Invaders. Oh. I totally forgot that part. Oh, it'll only hurt for a minute. Oh, really? Because this episode is 44 odd minutes and I am in a lot of pain. Speaking of a lot of pain.
Continued pain.
The birth scene. Oh my God. Mm-hmm. It goes on. I feel like this was filmed possibly in real time to what actually happened. The act.
How many takes did this actress have to do? That's what I would like to know.
So many. There is so much cringing, grunting, wailing. The bathroom at the prom, PS, is full of other people who I guess just think that she hasn't had any fiber since sophomore year. And then at last she gives birth. Brad Osborne is intoning about the baby's birth weight. Oh, also, you can't see this, and I'm not putting it in the visual aids, but the stunt bit, like the fake baby that they use, is so scary. And I think
it looked like a devil baby, like something they would use for as like a like an exorcist baby or a Rosemary's baby. So it's like, let's make it look creepy and disgusting.
And then they covered it in like Miracle Whip. I don't even. It's just, it's offensive. Yeah. But this is both the worst. I think this is the worst thing I've ever heard in any true crime property that I've ever reviewed. It is utterly gratuitous. Like, we see that she is in a bathroom stall. We do not need a Foley effect of the landing. And yet what we get is exactly that. It is gratuitous. It is revolting. It is offensive. And
you want to use the word? You texted it to me.
Bloop. I mean,
I'm
just
sorry.
Like, I would apologize for laughing, but I just, it's the show's fault. It's the show's fault.
Yes.
And
then one of the talking heads actually literally said this afterwards. He was like, giving birth alone can be extremely painful. It's a recipe for disaster. I just, oh my God. Everything that, like even this, what they, the talking aspects that they followed up the baby coming out with was just, it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And I think everybody's now going to like rent this. Now. I think
people are going to watch this. Is this a parody of itself? I really would like to know. But first, the ploop heard around the world. I am playing this clip in order to shame everyone involved, including us, for watching this entire episode. Here's clip 10.
After nearly half an hour, Melissa gives birth to a baby boy weighing just over 6 pounds.
What do I do?
The thing is, I think this actor is like actually not bad. Like, I think given what she was forced by this shite-tastic script to do, she does a pretty good job. I really felt like this is what it would have been like in that bathroom stall.
Can I read you?
But
I'm going to read you a line from my notes that I have right here. She had the Lamaze breathing down pat. What an actress.
Yeah.
She was good. It was good.
And then she's like, fuck, what do I do? What do I do? Like, I mean, she... And, you know, the boyfriend is like a doofus, but like everyone's fine, I guess, given what they're asked to do. But like these scenes just go on and on. Like maybe it's because I'm in the middle of series 7 of Call the Midwife, but like I am familiar with this process. I've watched television. We don't need a blow by blow, but the ploop sound that just sounds like a frog hitting a lily pad. Why was that not cut? Why did no one step in and say, no, that's revolting and it diminishes all of us?
See, but I keep thinking about how if there's people that follow both you and I on Twitter, and we will sometimes engage in our conversations or our battles, shall we say, about diner quotes or Ocean's quotes, there's so much material here for us that we could share back and forth of just absolutely ridiculously funny lines and quotes here. I mean, I did write down a lot of them. I really did.
I
think I will go back and watch this again to take down some more.
I mean, there's that ploop. this is what I was talking about in all seriousness in the first segment of this episode, that it's like when you review something like this as part of your job, is it your obligation to find Reel's headquarters and literally burn it to the ground? Because this is a serious issue. A little baby died. And it's not the only time. Like, they cite other cases. There have been many other cases. But are we just going to make this like a big trashy joke? Because that's what it is now. I'm going to wrap up with one last clip.
Okay.
Before which I will say to this People reporter dude that words have meaning, and repeating something in two different ways does not make it accurate when there is literally footage that aired right before your comments giving the lie to what you are about to say. That's not his fault. But this happens constantly in this episode. Here's our last clip.
I knew I was pregnant. I concealed the pregnancy from everyone. I went to the prom, I went into the bathroom and delivered the baby.
When Melissa read her statement in court, she was very quiet and barely audible.
That was actual Melissa Drexler. She was not quiet. She was not barely audible. The Talking Head interview after that is like, she was clearly very remorseful and she broke down. I'm like, that was a sing song. I'm not sorry I did it. I'm sorry I got caught reading if ever I fucking heard one. Look, I don't know her either. I don't know what actually happened. I do have compassion for her, but this entire show is like based on, let's just do these extremely florid, classless reenactments of terrible things that happen to average people, or terrible crimes committed by average people who refuse to talk to us.
I mean, it was basically a Florida man or Florida woman case, but it was set in New Jersey and they had something new that they could film about. That's how this whole thing felt to me. They realized they could write some really terrible lines and get some people to reenact it badly. And I think that was the purpose behind making this. Now, I haven't watched any other of this show's episodes of the other cases that they've done. I don't know if you have.
No.
I mean, is this a par for the course for what they do?
I mean, this is, I think, par for the course for Reels, which I think the autopsy show they do, they have a British Emmy who like looks at the documents and gives his take on people whose autopsies he didn't do. But mm-hmm. he can be sort of amusing because he pronounces the word cocaine, which is like, I don't think that's even a British thing, but whatever, go off guy. But like, this is what they do, that they're like, the last hours of Jim Morrison, the last hours of Whitney Houston. Like, it's stuff that you put on, I don't know, in a waiting room to mm-hmm. keep people. And then you put the captioning on and it's like, well, you know, fuck these people. But it's not, I mean, it's not prestige programming for sure. But even the title is so anodyne as to be meaningless. Like, Murder Made Me Famous. Like, uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah, I was waiting for like the Current Affair cutaway to young Bill O'Reilly covering this thing, which I didn't get. And the other thing I kept thinking about was, I actually did a Google search for this show and typed in The Soup afterwards. I was like, The Soup had to have mocked this.
Yeah.
They had to have covered this at some point, but I couldn't find anything that even came close to that. So maybe the show was done after The Soup left the air, how many ever years ago it was. I was stunned because they would have had a ball with this.
They really would have. I mean, yeah. There must be someone who's doing like the true crime version of The Soup.
Yeah.
Because you'll never run out of material, because as hard as they try to steer back towards some kind of prestige lane, the IDs and Oxygens and Friday Night on Networks of the world are always going to have this like wives with knives shit that they're like, the audience for this is not going to interrogate the sound design. And whoever is listening to this is probably like, Sarah and Mike, what did you expect? Like, I did not expect the ploop, listener, is what I did not expect. So I don't know. This is the thing. Like, I think that it is worth occasionally diving into. I'm sorry. There was just no other way I could find to put that. Watching is better. Something like this to just remind ourselves, like, that one's interest in true crime is not always, like I said in the first segment, it's not all, you know, honor. It's not all capes fluttering in the breeze. There is a lot of prurience that remains in this genre, but I think it is instructive to watch something like this and be like, this is, offensively poor on almost every level. Mm-hmm. And yet
we want everybody who's listening to go out and watch this, 'cause we need to see your comments. Because there is so much to comment on that we're not even touching on. So please go watch it after you listen to this, and please come back and post your comments.
Well, really, I think it's also worth like watching something like this and like laughing uncomfortably and then kind of sitting with the places where you laughed and being like, what is it about this 44-minute dumpster basically that... Yeah. led to this reaction, and is there, like, can we take anything away from this? I think the headline is, don't watch Reels.
Don't watch Reels. For Reels.
What else is there to say?
Sorry.
That baby deserved better, and so did we, frankly. And the next time I suggest that we watch something like this, here is what you need to say to me, Mike Dunn.
You know what I say about that? Fuck out of here with that.
Yeah.
Fuck out of here with that.
You really do need to say that.
Yes.
I don't know if we're still friends, but thank you for suffering through this with me.
In local news today, bees.
Mike, where else can listeners find you these days?
You can find me on Twitter at MikeyWMFree, Facebook, Instagram, all the regular social media accounts. And that's about it for right now. Or at my dining room table, because I'm not going anywhere for at least 9 months. Yeah.
Coming up on The Blutter Presents...
One more thing. Hey, this summer, when you're being inundated with all this American Bicentennial 4th of July brouhaha, don't forget what you're celebrating. And that's the fact that a bunch of slave-owning, aristocratic white males... didn't want to pay their taxes.
Yeah!
I've always loved that guy being like, yeah, what? Coming up on The Blotter Presents, I'm actually off next week for the 4th of July / anniversary week, but Best Evidence will be going strong, and mostly it's free. So subscribe to get the latest headlines on cases we've covered here, plus book reviews, blotter briefs, teehee briefs, and a sneak peek at what's ahead on the podcast. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media, Blotter Presents on Twitter and Instagram. My guest has been Mike Dunn, and he's on Twitter, like he said, at MikeyWMFree. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.